You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Day 5 in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell. It took place on Monday, the 14th of April, 2025. What happened in the courtroom? Well, we're about to break all of that down for you and spell it out and just take it piece by piece in a very digestible way without having to watch all of the testimony. So buckle up, as they say, because here we go. We're going to dig into what took place in that courtroom. And it was one of those days where you just didn't know what was going to happen. And what did happen by the end of the day? Well, Lori didn't exactly present the best sides of herself, to put it lightly. The courtroom was quiet as the first image hit the screen. They always warn the jury. These are graphic. And they are. Autopsy photos are never easy to look at, but this wasn't just a medical slideshow. It was a roadmap of a killing, not a theatrical one or a theoretical one either. Not a maybe. It's a forensic record, inch by inch, of what happened to Charles Vallow on the morning of July 11th, 2019. And from the moment Dr. Derek Baumgartner took the stand, the tone of the day was set. This wasn't going to be about beliefs or religious doomsday prophecies or who said what to whom. This was blood, trajectory, and bone. This was science, and science doesn't lie. Baumgartner is a forensic pathologist with the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office, the guy who sees what most of us would rather not think about. He walked the jury through what he saw that day in the lab. Charles Vallow, deceased, 2 gunshot wounds. One entered through the front of his chest, went straight through his heart, and exited out the back. The second entered lower. This one through the abdomen, passed through internal organs and muscle, and then exited near the upper back and upper left shoulder. It was clear. It was 2 separate shots, 2 distinct paths. That detail right there was important because the weapon used, identified later in the day, was a semi-automatic 45 caliber Springfield handgun, a gun that fires only once per trigger pull. There's no spray of bullets here, no accident where someone panicked and held the trigger too long. It's not like that. Each bullet was a decision. But it wasn't just the existence of the 2 wounds that raised eyebrows. It was how they were made. The chest wound had what's called stippling. Those little burns and abrasions caused by gunpowder residue. It tells you if the gun was fired from close range, not point blank. And that's important because closer you are, the more stippling you're going to get, the further back, the less you're going to get. It's just think of the dynamics if you're shooting a weapon and the firepower that initially is bursting that bullet out of there. That comes out too. You don't necessarily see it at the moment, but that has power. So it's trying to be determined if this was point blank or around somewhere to 2 to 4 feet away. That's close enough to see the whites of someone's eyes. The abdominal wound, no stippling, no soot. That one came from even further away, maybe 4 to 5 feet. That separation matters because it means the shots weren't fired in a single flurry of panic. They were spaced out. and at least one, maybe both, required moving and re-aiming. This wasn't chaos, it was control. But then came what might be the most quietly disturbing piece of evidence all day. The short exit wound. When a bullet exits the body, if there's a solid surface pushing back, like a floor, a wall, a belt, it creates a different kind of abrasion. Dr. Baumgartner called it textbook. One of the bullets exited through Charles' back while something was pressed up against him. And the most obvious candidate? The floor. Which suggests strongly that Charles was already down when the last shot was fired. No lunging, not fighting, just down. So he's down on the ground and somebody comes up, already down, finishes off the job. Now, the defense, if you can call it that, since Lori Vallow is representing herself, did try to poke at this. She asked if abrasions on Charles' knees could have come from a scuffle, not just from falling after being shot. The doctor agreed that was possible, but when she floated the idea that maybe it was Charles' tight bamboo-fibered shirt that caused the short exit wound, Baumgartner just quickly shut that down. It's not about fabric, it's about pressure, tension, a surface that pushes back as a bullet pushes through. He wasn't wearing Kevlar. In plain English, that bullet didn't just pass through a standing man. It went through someone who pressed into something solid, like a floor, not a shirt. And then came the twist. We know who fired the shots. Alex Cox, Lori's brother. He's admitted to it at the scene. Claimed it was self-defense. Claimed Charles came at him with a bat. And he did what he had to do. And when ballistics experts Nathan Moberg took the stand, he confirmed what the police suspected all along. The two casings found at the scene matched the .45 caliber Springfield that Alex turned over to police. Moberg test-fired it himself and compared the unique markings, firing pin impression, extractor marks, microscopic scrapes like fingerprints for bullets, kind of. No ambiguity there. The two casings from the Vallow home came from Alex's gun. Now, Lori, again, acting as her own attorney, tried to make something out of where the casings landed. She asked Moberg about how they might bounce or roll. He explained that, sure, casings can go in unpredictable directions when ejected from a gun, especially if it's being held at an odd angle. But here's the thing. No matter where the shells landed, they still tell the same story. They came from that gun. Two rounds, two trigger pulls, two rounds. No misfire. No malfunction. Just bullets that were exactly where someone pointed them. And that's where things start to get uncomfortable for Lori, because when the jury watched the excerpts from her 2019 police interview played in full view of the court, something didn't line up. Lori told investigators she heard a shot. One, not two, just one bang. She said she saw Charles on the floor. That was it. Never mentioned a second shot, never mentioned Alex firing again. And that detail may seem small, but it matters because when you're the spouse, the one at the scene, and your brother just killed your husband, you'd think you'd remember how many times the gun went off. Her story didn't match the evidence, and the jury saw that in real time too. The autopsy says two bullets. The casings say two bullets. The gun says two trigger pulls. Lori says one shot. It's Lori. And her world is her world, and we all are just grateful to live in it. At least that's how she'd like it. And maybe that was a mistake. Maybe she didn't hear the second one. Maybe she was outside. Maybe this isn't a courtroom built on maybes. That's the problem here. And the prosecution doesn't need to prove Lori pulled the trigger. They're focused on what she saw, what she said, and what she did before and after those shots rang out. So what are we left with? Well, two shots. Not one fired deliberately. Not in a frenzy, one possibly while Charles was already down, maybe even dying. Fired from a gun owned and carried by her brother Alex Cox, a brother Lori had called to the house that morning, a brother who just so happened to be there when Charles came over to pick up JJ, and a brother who, after firing those rounds, would later die himself under what many still consider murky circumstances. But back to the facts. The facts! They say that Charles Vallow was alive when the first bullet entered his chest and shredded through his heart. He was probably still alive, just barely, when the second one tore through his torso. The facts say the shooter used a functioning weapon that required two deliberate trigger pulls, and the facts say Lori Vallow, at best, gave an incomplete version of what happened that day, and at worst, a misleading one. And in today's courtroom, the prosecution wasted no time making one thing clear. This wasn't just about a murder. They say it was about money, cold, federally issued, systematically deposited, easy to spend money. And the jury got to see every line of it. It started with Mark Sari, an investigator with the Office of the Inspector General for the Social Security Administration. He wasn't flashy, no dramatic pauses, no sweeping gestures, just a man with documents, timelines, and a kind of bureaucratic precision that can quietly demolish a defense. Sari took to the stand and calmly laid out how, within weeks of Charles' death, Lori Vallow walked into his Social Security office and applied for survivor benefits. Not just for her son, JJ, who was entitled to them as a minor. She applied for herself, too. Here's how that works. When someone dies and they leave behind a minor child, the surviving parent, if they were living with the deceased and haven't remarried, can receive what's called a mother's benefit. It's not a fortune, but it's steady. And in this case, Sari explained, Lori received about $1,951 a month for JJ, and an additional $1,951 for herself, nearly $4,000 a month, starting shortly after Charles died and ending only when Lori remarried Chad Daybell in November of 2019. Let that sink in. The timeline. It matters. Charles was shot on July 11th. By August 12th, Lori was at a Social Security office, paperwork in hand, telling the federal government she was a widow still living with her husband at the time of his death. This despite the ongoing chaos in her personal life, despite the investigation, despite everything else. She was organized enough to claim benefits just a month after the shooting. And the way Sari put it, she was confident. She knew the system. She knew how to file. She even brought documentation to prove her marriage to Charles was intact. Now, just because someone applies for survivor benefits doesn't mean they're guilty of anything. That's important. But what stood out on this day in court was how seamless and prompt Lori's actions were. It wasn't sloppy. It wasn't delayed. It was targeted, efficient, and it was lucrative. According to records, she received not only the monthly checks, but also a lump sum of back pay, roughly $4,000 for herself and another for JJ, covering the weeks between Charles' death and the approval date. All told, within months of the shooting, Lori had collected close to $8,000 in federal funds tied directly to Charles' death. And it didn't end there. Sari also dug into the benefits Tylee Ryan, Lori's teenage daughter, had already been receiving from her biological father's passing in 2018. Notice a trend? Lori had been acting as the payee of that account too, which meant that by mid-2019, she was handling three separate Social Security payouts, one for JJ, one for Tylee, and one for herself. Starting to see how lucrative this is, it seems. All that, all three, flowing through her. That level of control over the money wasn't just incidental. It was institutional. It was intentional. On cross-examination, Lori, representing herself, tried to twist the edges of Sari's testimony. She asked about other types of spousal benefits as she meandered on. I don't know if that's even a word. One that might apply even without minor children involved. Could a spouse still be eligible? What if there were multiple former spouses? How could the government split that? Well, Sari answered each question with the patience of someone who'd been through audits before. Yes, in some cases, a former spouse could qualify, but Lori's case was straightforward. She qualified for the caregiver benefit because JJ was underage and Charles was his legal adoptive father. Lori was legally entitled to that money until she remarried Chad Daybell, which she did in November, cutting off her portion but leaving JJ's intact. It wasn't what Lori was asking that caught the jury's attention. It was why she was asking. These weren't the questions of a grieving widow seeking clarity. These were the questions of someone dissecting eligibility rules, looking for technicalities, trying to reframe motive through policy jargon. It didn't work. Sari had the documents, and more importantly, he had the dates. The prosecution rested their case with a simple takeaway. Lori didn't stumble into a government payout. She walked right into the office and asked for it fast. But the Social Security piece showed intent. The life insurance angle showed expectation, because Lori didn't just collect what the government offered. She also tried to claim what Charles had set aside for his family. A $1 million life insurance policy through Banner Life. And this part of the story came with receipts, emails, and most damaging of all, recorded phone calls that jurors got to hear in Lori's own voice. The Banner Life representative took the stand and explained how the process works. When someone passes away and the insurance company is notified, they send out claim packets to listed beneficiaries. If someone calls in and they're not the beneficiary, the company doesn't tell them who is. They just inform them they're not getting the money. Simple, polite, bureaucratic. That's exactly what happened. On July 15th, just 4 days after Charles was killed, Lori Vallow called Banner Life. She spoke to a rep, gave her name and address, and confidently asked how to claim life insurance payouts. She was calm, almost chipper, clearly expecting to be the primary beneficiary. But she wasn't. Unbeknownst to Lori, Charles had removed her from the policy months earlier. On February 26th of 2019, he submitted a notarized change of beneficiary form naming his sister Kay Woodcock as the new primary recipient. If anything happened to Kay, the contingent beneficiaries were Charles' adult sons, not Lori. And this charge wasn't a maybe. It was processed, recorded, and confirmed long before Charles died. So when Lori called Banner Life and learned she wasn't the beneficiary, she was surprised. On the follow-up call recorded on July 18th, Lori sounded a little frustrated. She told the rep she had been listed as the sole beneficiary for years. Then she floated a guess that maybe Charles had shifted things so she'd get 80% and two of his employees would split the rest. An odd theory. And one that was completely incorrect. The rep politely corrected her. She wouldn't be receiving anything, and they couldn't say who would. That's when the jury heard the tone shift. Lori's voice went from confident to annoyed. She said, "I'm just trying to figure out what he was doing. We have five kids." It wasn't anger over his death. It was irritation over the money. Her focus was on the decision Charles had made to exclude her. She even framed it like a betrayal, not of love or trust, but of financial obligation. That's the part that stuck. Lori believed she was entitled to that million. She said as much. She asked how to get it. She thought it was hers, and only after being told she was out of the loop did she backpedal and start guessing. In court, the prosecution played these calls without commentary. They didn't have to explain. Lori's voice did the work for them. There were no big objections during the segment, no outbursts. Lori didn't cross-examine the insurance witness at all. She just sat there listening to her own words from 6 years ago, words that suggested she'd counted on that payout. Built it into her reality, and only discovered too late that Charles had made other plans. Charles seemed to have seen this coming. That's the prosecution's theory. Now that Lori murdered, not that Lori murdered Charles with her own hands, but that she set the table, that she provoked the confrontation, and she brought her brother into the home that morning, and that she expected financially and emotionally to walk away from the wreckage with full control. Only it didn't work out that way. Charles was gone, but the money never came. Not at all. Or not all of it, anyway. Yeah, that sounds cold. Just wait. Because what follows, the checks, the calls, and the policy updates, was something even more disturbing. Not what Lori said, but how she said it. Not how she answered questions, but how she responded to the death itself, the behavior, the choices, the silence. A lot came out of Lori. That's one thing to be accused of murder. It's another to be the person on trial who seems entirely unaffected by it. If there was any moment in this case where the jury got a front row seat to Lori Vallow's state of mind, not as prosecutors described it, but in her own words, her own voice, her own choices, it was day five. And honestly, no expert witness could have delivered what Lori gave them for free, a living, breathing contradiction of how grief, fear, and even basic human panic usually shows up after someone's been killed. Detective Cassandra Yenklan was the one who brought the receipts. Not literal receipts, but the kind that stick with you. She was on duty with Chandler Police Department the morning Charles Vallow was killed. She wasn't assigned to the case initially. In fact, she was on her way to a community outreach event when the call came in. Homicide at a residence. She rerouted and arrived at the scene around 9:30 a.m., shortly after patrol had already taped things off. Now, remember, this is moments after Charles Vallow was shot. Two bullets, one of them possibly fired while he was already down on the floor. And the man who pulled the trigger, Alex Cox, Lori's brother, is calmly sitting on a curb outside the house like he just finished mowing the lawn. That's where Detective Yenklan finds him. No tears, no visible shock. Just a man dabbing the back of his head with a tissue, casually tending to the small wound he claims Tylee gave him, or rather Charles gave him, with a baseball bat, while the story is that he was trying to protect Tylee, that Charles was coming after him. It's weird, sure, but it's what she sees next that really sets the tone for this chapter. Lori! Now, keep in mind, at this point, the police didn't even know who had done what yet. There's a woman standing with a teenage girl near the crime scene tape, looking relatively calm, talking to an officer. That officer tells Detective Yenklan, that's the wife of the deceased. The teenage girl is her daughter. That's Tylee. And neither of them are falling apart. They're not hysterical. They're not crying. They're not even really reacting. So Detective Yenklan does what any investigator with a pulse would do. She walks over to break the news, officially. She's going to tell Lori that her husband, Charles, is dead. But here's where things take a turn. Before she can even get the words out, Lori says something that makes the room go quiet. She tells the detective, I already know. Just like that. Calm, no tears. Just a flat statement. I already know what you're going to say. Let's hit pause on that for just a second. Because here's the thing. As far as protocol goes, the police hadn't confirmed Charles was dead to her yet. Sure, maybe she assumed it. Maybe she guessed. But this wasn't speculation on Lori's part. It was presented like a fact that she was already comfortable with. No shock, no confusion. She just sat in the care unit van with her daughter, waiting to be taken to the police station, and then the detective gave her the official confirmation, and Lori didn't even flinch. From there, Detective Yenklin took Lori and Tylee down to the Family Advocacy Center for interviews. The detective herself drove them, Lori in the front passenger seat, Tylee in the back. It's about a 20-minute ride, and what happens in that car says more than anything, Lori said in her police interview. Because what does Lori do during that drive? She chats. Not nervously, not awkwardly, just chats about school, about Tylee, about life. You know, like she just got back from a soccer game. Not a homicide scene. According to Detective Yenklin, Lori didn't ask once about Charles. Not once about her brother, who had just shot him. Not once about what would happen next. No concerns. No questions. No grief. Just easy, casual conversation like nothing out of the ordinary had happened. And then there's Charles' phone. Came out during testimony that Lori had Charles' phone with her the entire time. She never told anyone. She brought it with her to the station. Wasn't recovered at the scene. And the police didn't even know she had it until later. That's not just odd. That's calculated. Phones are digital diaries. They hold everything. Texts, call logs, apps, passwords. Taking it, keeping it, not mentioning it? That's not the move of someone caught up in the moment. That's someone thinking ahead. Once at the station, Lori and Tylee are split up, two different rooms, two interviews, and the jury saw clips from Lori's on-camera statement. If anyone was hoping for a breakdown or some remorse, they didn't get it. What they got was Lori admitting on video that she started the argument that morning, that she took Charles' phone, knowing it would upset him. She said it casually, like she'd hidden the remote control during a petty argument. Not like she'd sparked the fuse of a deadly confrontation. And she laughed. She laughed when describing how Tylee grabbed a baseball bat to protect her. She even joked that since Charles had been a college baseball player, maybe a bat wasn't the best weapon to challenge him with. That wasn't nervous laughter. It wasn't shock. It was a chuckle. Delivered with a kind of flippancy that made everyone in the courtroom glance around like, did she really just do that? She told detectives she heard a shot. Not shots. Not multiple gunshots. Just one. And again, this is important because the forensic testimony was clear. There were two bullets, two casings, two distinct paths through Charles' body. If Lori only heard one, she either wasn't where she claimed to be or she was deliberately minimizing what happened. And remember, Lori had brought Alex to the house that morning. She knew Charles was coming to pick up JJ. She admitted she'd taken the phone to provoke a response. She was laying the groundwork for a confrontation, and when it exploded, she positioned herself outside, literally and figuratively. After the interview, Detective Yenklin took Lori, Tylee, and Alex back to the house in a police van. This time, Lori sat next to Alex. Tylee was up front. The two detectives sat in the back, listening. And according to Yenklin, Lori did not stop talking the whole way. Not about Charles, not about the investigation. Again, about life. About plans. Like the day hadn't included a homicide. Now, Lori tried to chip away at this during her cross-examination. I put that in air quotes. She questioned Detective Yenklin's memory, challenging whether it was really her doing all the talking. Maybe it was Alex and Tylee. Maybe she was just staring out the window, quietly processing. But the detective didn't budge. She doubled down. Lori was the one chatting. Lori was the one steering the conversation. Lori was the one behaving like she just finished a grocery run, not a post-interview ride from a murder scene. Lori also tried to dig into whether it was appropriate for Tylee to be interviewed without a parent present. Was it consent? Did they have the right training? Yenklin made it clear she was a certified child forensic interviewer. Lori had agreed to the interviews. Nothing was done without transparency. It was another attempt by Lori to shift focus away from what she said and did and onto how others handled it. But it did not work. The jury saw the interview. They heard Lori's voice. They watched the clips of her chuckling about the baseball bat. They saw her describe Charles' death with all the emotional weight of someone retelling a mildly inconvenient trip to Costco. She wasn't panicked. She wasn't grieving. She wasn't even uncertain. She was composed. She was cheerful. She was, according to one detective, completely unaffected. And when she stood up in court to cross-examine that same detective, the chill nerve broke. Or the chill never broke, I should say. She spoke with the same detached tone, the same casual demeanor, the same flat affect that she had back in 2019, as if nothing had changed. As if nothing needed to, as if she was representing Lori Vallow-Daybell and Lori was someone else, not her. The state didn't need to paint her as cold or calculating. She did that herself. Through her words, through her behavior, through her complete absence of grief. And that's what the courtroom was left with. A defendant who didn't need to be caught in a lie because her silence, her laughter, and her complete emotional vacancy told the jury everything they needed to know. Not about what she did, but about who she was while it was happening. And that's a lot to take in. It's a lot to contemplate. It's a lot to process. Because what are you looking at there? I mean, she does follow the classic narcissistic playbook, without a doubt, to an extreme. But the answer is, you'll never know what you're looking at there because Lori's a chameleon. Lori will change her story. Lori will change her beliefs. Lori will change her motive. Lori will change her story. She'll change everything to fit the narrative that fits her best. That is how she functions. And in this case, this is how she functioned. And you'll notice that throughout the entire trial, you'll notice throughout anything in this case or the previous case, that's exactly what she does. It doesn't have to make sense because we're all living in Lori's world. Lori isn't in our world. And her narrative is always true in Lori land. Never mind, it changes. History, that's malleable. And in her mind, it is. Everyone else is crazy if they're not going to go down her road of seeing it. And she believes it. How could someone believe it? Well, just look it up a little bit. Look up narcissistic personality disorder. Look up borderlines. Look up everything that she's been diagnosed with. You'll learn. When you do, you see these patterns and you see how they're acting, and it's not surprising anymore. It's not just chaotic randomness. It's, this makes more sense. We're doing a lot of that in the trial of Karen Reed right now as well. And to kind of understand what the mold is, it's a little easier to predict the reactions and how one's going to play the cards they're dealt after someone's dead. And surprise, they're pretty good at making themselves the victim, even when it doesn't make sense. Even when you're making up stories and history changes. That's day 5 of the trial of Lori Vallow-Daybell. Let me know in the comments what you think. Love to hear it. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts as well. And if you're on YouTube, press subscribe there so you don't miss any of our coverage of this case. We're bringing it to you every single day. Audio of the case we're providing to you on our podcast channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Just go search that. You will find it. And you can stream the trial on your pace. And all those long dead spaces, they're not there. We got the content for you. So check that out. Take it with you wherever you go. And like I said, on the comments on YouTube, what do you think so far of the Lori Vallow trial now that we've completed day 5? What does day 6 bring us? Well, we'll find that out very soon. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now. and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.